To order our Coachella Valley Conservation Commission meeting for Thursday, November the 13th. We have a quick roll call, please?
Absolutely. City of Cathedral City. City of Coachella.
Present.
Coachella Valley Water District. City of Desert Hot Springs.
Present.
Imperial Irrigation District.
Good morning, present.
City of Indian Wells.
Present.
City of Indio.
Present.
City of La Quinta.
Present.
Mission Springs Water District.
Present.
City of Palm Desert. City of Palm Springs. City of Rancho Mirage.
Here.
Riverside County District 1. Riverside County District 2.
Present.
Riverside County District 3.
Here.
Riverside County District 4.
Here.
Riverside County District 5. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Let's start with our pledge. And since he's already standing, I'm going to ask Dana to lead us in it today.
Please join me. Ready? Begin.
All right. Thank you, Dana. All right. Do we have any agenda modifications or changes?
We do not.
Right, seeing none, we'll accept the agenda as is and move on to our public comments on agenda items. Do we have any public comments? And please note that our Cathedral City Rep has just showed up. Mr. Gutierrez.
No, Chair, we have not received any public comments.
All right, no comments. Our Commission Chair Directors, I just have a couple of things I wanted to bring up real quick. We saw a number of you at the Friends of the Desert Mountains dinner last night, which was very fun and successful. And they raised quite a few. Do you? I left before the auction was over. Linda, do you know how much they ended up raising?
I don't, but maybe Oscar can give us an update. He was putting away chairs.
Yeah, it was a very fun dinner, and they're a great organization. One of our partners here at CBCC that does a lot of work. And then lastly, our executive director asked me a couple of weeks ago to go to Ontario in the middle of the day. Thanks a lot. For a discussion with PBS SoCal on our conservation efforts here. They had a round table of a bunch of conservation organizations, and we sat around for an hour and discussed efforts. And most of the organizations were over on the Inland Empire and coastal sides, but myself and we had a representative from MDLT and from Cactus to Clouds there. And it was a good, productive afternoon. They were looking for long-term story ideas, and so we discussed some things here in the desert. Particularly, they seemed intrigued about our string of pearls around the valley with all of our conserved land and our national monuments and national parks. So we'll have to watch for some stuff maybe coming out of PBS SoCal on that. Next agenda item. Okay. Yes.
What's MDLT?
Mojave Desert Land Trust.
Thank you.
They're up in...
I know what it is. I just couldn't the dots didn't. Thank you.
Okay, you had something.
Just to remind everybody that there are microphones in the ceiling, and it does pick up even a little bit of a whisper from anybody here or even in the audience, and that we are on Zoom.
And even thoughts, right?
Why are you thinking that? All right, on our consent calendar, do we have anybody who would like to pull anything from the consent calendar or have any comments?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. We have nothing held over from the consent calendar last time. We'll move on to our discussion and agenda items. And up first is the acquisition of one parcel in the Upper Mission Creek Big Morongo Canyon Conservation Area. Diana, our good friend from CVMC, is here. Go ahead, Diana.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Diana Rosas. I'm Associate Director of the Coachella Valley Mountains Conservancy, serving today as Acquisition Manager for the Conservation Commission. And today I'm presenting a 10.77-acre property for your consideration in the Upper Mission Creek Big Morongo Canyon Conservation Area. To give you an orientation of the location of the conservation area, to the west is the Whitewater Canyon and to the east is Joshua Tree National Park. This conservation area serves as a wildlife blueprint corridor and has critical biological and watershed significance for several covered species under the plan, including the burrowing owl, the Chow Valley round-tailed ground squirrel, desert tortoise, Lacan's thrasher, Little San Bernardino Mountains Linanthus, and the Palm Springs pocket mouse. This area encompasses lands within city limits of Desert Hot Springs and unincorporated Riverside County. The total acreage for this conservation area is approximately 29,440 acres. The goal is to conserve 10,810 acres of contiguous habitat and effective linkages. As of 2024, 7,603 acres have been conserved. The map on the screen shows conserved parcels in green. Historically, CVCC prioritized this area due to the potential for high development, which is still a concern today. Staff is continuing to prioritize its acquisition efforts in this area to advance and meet conservation goals. In September 2024, we targeted properties based on potential willing sellers and contracted for an appraisal to determine the fair market value of the targeted properties. The appraiser valued this 10.77 acre parcel at $140,000. The parcel is located at Dillon Road, east of Nancy Drive and west of Palm Drive, within a potentially highly developable area in the city of Desert Hot Springs. So why is this parcel important? We targeted this parcel as CVCC already owns contiguous habitat, which will allow staff to better manage the conserved lands. Acquiring the property will not only help CVCC staff to better manage the area, but will also contribute to the state's 30 by 30 initiative to conserve 30% of California lands and coastal waters by the year 2030. CVCC is also working on a cleanup effort through a CalRecycle grant in this area, which staff will discuss in a later action item. My team of acquisition managers have been working with the seller for over a year to ensure that the property met all contingencies of the purchase agreement, including a physical site inspection of the property, removal of dumping and any potential hazardous conditions, and clearance of title to the property. During our due diligence process, three potential issues arose and were resolved. First, although a well was identified, it was confirmed to be properly kept and abandoned, meaning it is no longer active or being monitored. Second, during the negotiation process, we determined there may have been a septic tank on the property, but that septic tank was likely collapsed and filled during the demolition of the original homestead cabin in 1986. Third, our physical inspection also showed dumping throughout the property. Here you'll see some pictures of the dumping and some after the cleanup was done. Our acquisition team worked with the seller to remove the dumping and properly dispose of it. Approximately 1.82 tons of miscellaneous debris and 20 tires were removed from the property. Because the identified issues were resolved and because this area is critical for conservation, staff recommends the approval of the resolution 2025-07 as noted in the staff report. I'm happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you, Diana. Anybody have any questions?
It's just on the illegal dumping issue, obviously it's throughout the entire Fourth District. But what we were able to do with, I think, a fair amount of success, although it's ongoing, at least on the east end, especially on tribal land, which is very difficult to manage and many times to get into. But nonetheless, those conversations have taken place. A group of folks came together in which we created the, on one front, the illegal dumping task force committee. And then on another front, remember the burning issues that we had at one time? You hardly see that now. And I think on both fronts, quite frankly, we've been somewhat successful. Obviously, people are still going to do what they do. But the reason why I bring it up is because I'm wondering if this is a time outside of this recommendation, maybe to initiate that conversation once again and see how we can now expand that effort to the west end of the valley. Just want to put that out there.
If I might, Chair, yeah. And Supervisor, the last item on your discussion action list here is cleanup of illegal dump sites. Will, on our staff, is going to be giving you a presentation on a more global approach. That'd be a good time to chat about that sort of approach, too.
Thank you. All right, go ahead, Evan.
Thank you. And you know, this thought just occurred to me, and I maybe should have asked it in one of my earlier meetings, but spent a lot of time in the former Maquoketa wilderness, which is now Chalkwala. And it seems what the BLM did to preserve that land is it was almost a checkerboard pattern. Mm-hmm. They buy half the lots, whereas we seem to be on a path to, and so effectively you're preserving the same amount of land at half the cost, whereas we seem to be on a pattern of trying to kind of preserve every single thing contiguously. Is there one method that's better? Do we make a decision a long time ago just to try to kind of block off every parcel together, or is there one method that's better than another? Or,
well, you get back to that, where those original BLM parcels that are in the checkerboard pattern are much like what you have in Palm Springs. They were originally granted to the United States government when the railroad went through back in, well, before any of us were even conceived. And so that's why you have those original checkerboard patterns that were always have been federal land. And then you have the other pieces that were sold off. And then eventually what we'll try to do is buy all those. We didn't have that issue on this end of the valley so much on the Desert Hot Springs side, but that's where a lot of that came from when you go out there towards
and,
there.
And this commission's kind of practice has been acquire perhaps those that are most vulnerable, the largest that we could capture potentially. And then as they become available for sale and or the tax components when they're defaulted on the taxes, then we have the opportunity to acquire them. So that's why I'm looking at this one thinking this is probably one of the most affordable pieces of 10 acres that we've had, because a few of the other ones that have come before us lately have been pretty pricey. And the fact that you got it cleaned up before we acquired it, because what would that have cost us? Probably several thousand dollars if it's 180 tons. Okay. So, yeah.
Okay. And comparing BLM strategy versus what we're doing is apples and oranges, because that wasn't by design. That was more an effect of. Okay. Got it.
Yep. That's pretty good. So, and then this is a nice piece too, and just Mr. Executive Director, that if we're ever going to piece a CV link up through there, we're going to have some nice little, just laying it out there. So, do we have any more discussion? Seeing none, I'll take a motion.
Prior to the vote, I would like to welcome the Coachella Valley Water District, City of Palm Desert, and Riverside County District 5.
Thank you.
Okay, the kingdom moves approval.
Second.
Second.
Motion and a second. All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Diana. Next up, we have a presentation on our 30 by 30 wildlife connectivity project. And Katie, if you would be so kind as to introduce our professor, who I believe is on Zoom.
Sure. So a little over a year ago, we were pleased to bring to you that we had received a Wildlife Conservation Board grant for a 30 by 30 I-10 wildlife connectivity study that we were fortunate enough to partner with UC Davis on. And so today we wanted to give you an update on that study. It's been in the field, and we've been working with Shannon Lemieux and Dr. Fraser Schilling from UC Davis Road Ecology Center there. And they've been running our field team, providing just all of the staff support that we needed to try to get at least the field portion of this done. So Dr. Fraser should be on the Zoom.
Okay.
And he, as you know, he is actually been the PI on a number of these different studies throughout the state. And he's also just recently finished a similar study that was for Highway 62. So this was one of the reasons that we were super excited to partner with UC Davis on this. And Dr. Schilling.
Thanks. And hi, everybody. Sorry I couldn't be there in person, but thanks for having us here or there and allowing us to present. One of my staff is there, Shannon Lemieux. She should be able to give you some in-person information if you need. She actually just came back from the field trapping small mammals throughout the CVCC linkage areas, and can give you some of that information too. We had a success last night. And if I could get the title slide. Okay, there we go. I want to acknowledge that this is a big team, a big effort. My co-PI, Fernando Najera, and his staff, Lena Vu and Emily Carr, helped us get set up. And then I've had a lot of students and staff involved, including Shannon, who's led our field effort over the last couple of years. We also have a couple of collaborators, one from UCLA, Dr. Travis Longcore, and Barry Martin, who's a tracker who went out throughout our study area and look for animal sign to help us collect data. And you can see some of the pictures we got from cameras, and Shannon can talk more about that in a moment. Next slide. So the project workflow was to collect a variety of different types of data about wildlife movement, wildlife occurrence, and also things that might disturb that. That includes land development, roads, power generation, like the windmills, noise and light from all of that. And there's also what we call existing structures under the highway. So you could picture the Whitewater River Bridge or the San Gorgonio River Bridge. There's where the PCT goes under Stubby. Stubby Canyon Wash has a twin pair of bridges there. We call those existing structures. We also looked at how well those were functioning already to allow wildlife to go through. And at the end of all this, we analyze all the data we've collected, looking at this wildlife movement, basically connecting that string of pearls. So we got, pearls on one side of the valley and the other, and how do we connect them through this area, and identifying places where we might be able to make those connections. And those include potential for new overcrossings across I-10, which you can imagine would be quite an endeavor, and also enhancement of existing structures. And again, those are the bridges and big culverts that already are providing some wildlife movement. Then we'll contribute to the design, help with the design parts of that, but that's being led by Dock and Engineering and their subs. So we're working in partnership with them to get some final designs and get that ready for Caltrans approval and further funding. Next slide. Actually, I'm going to hand off to Shannon here.
Hi, as I said, I'm Shannon Lemieux. I am a part of Dr. Fraser's team with the Road Ecology Center. Forgive me if I have to repeat anything twice. We're coming directly from the field, so bear with me. So this is going to be a map of the raw data that we collected via camera traps. Those pictures you saw at the beginning were all taken from camera traps in the area. And you'll see a gradient of colors on how many individual species we were able to identify at each of the camera trap locations. All of the camera trap data amounted to about 6,000 camera trap days and over 50, so 57 total cameras were placed over the course of about a year. So you'll see all the way west at Banning Pass and then all the way east over to Whitewater. And the trend you can see here is that we are able to see more species away from the highway than at the highway. And then just to give you a little bit more detail, all of these circles that are located on the actual 10, those are placed at culverts and existing undercrossings and bridges, so in and at both ends. This is another form of raw data that we collected. It's animal sign. Dr. Fraser said at the beginning that we hired Barry Martin, and he's a tracker, so he went out and looked on the ground and looked at scat and sign for like tracks and middens and anything that would basically say this animal was here. And so this is points across the whole entire study area of where he found sign of animals. We then, in addition to not only looking at what species were away from the highway, as well as along the highway, we wanted to quantify the noise and light that animals would be experiencing as they're approaching those existing structures and highway areas in general. So you can see all of the blue points along the highway and in the background areas here, they represent noise measurements taken. Everything we did within the structure was taken at both ends and in the middle so that we were able to compare how much sound is dampened as animals went through the structure. And then you can see that we also did transects leading up to potential or existing structures and potential areas that animals might cross. So you'll see a few transects, and it helped us compare, okay, what are they experiencing in the background? What are they experiencing as they get to the highway? And then what are they experiencing if they're able to cross? We did that for noise, and we also did that for light. So we went out in a team and did night field work, And we basically did this, we tried to do all of the structures as well as the same transects that we did for noise. So again, everything on the 10 is within or approaching a structure. So we were able to quantify what are animals seeing as they approach these structures and what are they experiencing inside the structures, as well as some transects, these two notably around Fornat Wash and in the Whitewater Wash, of areas that we thought, just looking at everything in the field, where we would see animals moving through. You can kind of see on the left-hand side on figure 4, the horizon luminance along the Fornat transect. You can see it gets brighter as you go towards the highway, with the exception of this one area, the yellowish dots in the bottom of the transect. That is from the water processing building that is right there that have lights on 24/7. So we were able to not only capture light and noise from the highway, but we're also able to capture light and noise of different local roads and buildings and illuminated billboards. So other sources as well that are not just the road, but permanent fixtures in the study area. This is a spatial graph showing the observed species that we saw on each segment of the highway. These are mammals and herpafauna that we saw. So what we did is we took the entire segment of I-10 and we split it up into 15 segments. And we said, okay, let's compare these 15 segments and see what segments look better in these four, like these many areas: noise, light, observed species, predicted species, to quantify what areas we want to focus on or give our recommendation that we focus on. So for this, it's observed species, which is all mammals and herpetofauna that we saw, which does not include birds or bats, just because they use crossings differently. So anything on the ground, you'll see that the higher number of species observed from our cameras and tracking sign are going to be in the yellow color. So that is going to be segment 6 and 7 right here, which is by the stubby crossing, which, if you can imagine, the PCT goes right through there. So that's one area of high number of species that we observed. And then you can see different numbers as we go out. On both the far left, so as you get into more civilization, we kind of saw less observed species at the highway, and then there was varying number of species across the rest of the highway.
And just to add to that, so the numbers next to the highway are not the number of species. The colors represent the number of species. The numbers next to the highway are just segment numbers.
Correct. Thank you.
This is confusing.
So just take the yellow of the most, 49 to 58. Over what period?
So it's about a year and a half. And these are number of species. So not numbers of individuals. Instead of, like, if you had 5 coyotes pass through, it would only be 1 because it is 1 species. So we are trying to quantify, this is more diversity of species rather than number of individuals going through. This was all the field data collected in about a year and a half. So I do want to say it is also biased by sampling effort and intensity, and we'll kind of get into that in a slide or two. But you'll see over here in, like, the Whitewater area, especially in the Whitewater Hills, we were unable to act. Well, one, there's no structure along segment 2, existing structure that we were looking at. So we didn't have a camera there. And going up on this hill where I'm sure with the wind turbines are, we couldn't access up there. So a little bit is biased in certain areas more over to the east side by sampling effort and intensity, but I'll get to that in a second of how we kind of calibrated for that. So this is basically the same graph, but predicted species. So we looked at the habitat within the area and we said, okay, if we were gonna take it, what species would you predict to see here? So these cameras that we put up are not gonna capture everything, just because things don't move on nice time scales to be able to capture everything like we wish. So this is also comparing, we're looking at what was predicted there and is it high as well. So on this one, the darker red means higher and the yellow now means less predicted species. So again, we see in the Whitewater area, we see a high number of predicted species. And then again, around that stubby wash area where the PCT is. And note that the scale is much larger than observed species. Like I just said, the cameras aren't going to pick up everything, and we can't have someone sitting there 24/7 as much as I would love to do that. You know, human limitations.
And the predictions, actually, go back to that one. The predictions come from California Department of Fish and Wildlife models for where species are likely to occur. So these aren't our predictions. These are Department of Fish and Wildlife prediction models for where species occur.
And for both predicted and observed species, we looked within a mile of the highway, and then we basically attributed each segment to that segment of the highway. So it's not just along the highway that you're seeing. These attributes are from about a mile away. So what would, and a mile is where we see noise and light kind of start to wane their giant effects on the species. So it'd be like, what species is approaching the highway and what species would we expect to be in that area, a potential cross? And right. I'll turn it over to Dr. Fraser.
You can just call me Fraser. So the noise model, this is from a noise model we built statewide, actually, and we've used it in this area quite a bit and validated it using field measurements of noise. So it's a pretty accurate model. And the purpose of it is to say what areas, if any, are noisier or quieter next to the road. And we generally find that the highway is very noisy, over 80 A-weighted decibels. And A-weighted decibels, or dBA, is the part of the sound frequencies that are most worrying to humans. They cause the most health effects, but they also are the most disturbing to wildlife, because most of the, at least mammalian wildlife. So the area around Whitewater was the quietest, and that's because it's got that deep canyon, but it's still relatively loud. So for pretty much the whole stretch of the study area, we're looking at very loud conditions adjacent to the highway. And these noise levels are well above thresholds for making wildlife stay away. So even though we do have wildlife come to this area, they are occasionally going through the structures. It's loud enough that if and when they're going through, it's probably under kind of a disturbed or stressed situation. They go through it. They're not living nearby, except for the ones that are more tolerant. And that would include maybe some of the rabbits and squirrels and things like that. Next slide. We also looked at ownership. And this goes back to Shannon's earlier comment about where we're actually able to collect data. So we only collected data in publicly owned parcels, which really limited our data collection to the west, because those are Morongo lands or private parcels throughout. So if there was a county road, the highway, and other conservation and public ownerships, then we were able to sample. But conservation lands also tell us these are going to be the easiest places to do something. For example, build a crossing structure where your footprint might extend beyond the Caltrans right-of-way, the highway right-of-way. And so you'd want to have that access, land access, which can be gained with right-of-way acquisition during transportation projects. That's fairly normal, but it makes it a little easier to get funding if you know you've already got the land to do something. Next slide. Another problem we had, which is not just a problem with wildlife being present, but a problem with theft. So it's both. We had a lot of people at these structures, and we lost a lot of cameras. We kept having to buy new ones and put them up. We'd get them stolen again. And you can see that it goes up into the hundreds of people, not individual people. It could be somebody repeatedly occurring there. Maybe they live nearby under the structure or something like that. So some of these structures are very heavily populated, with the exception of Stubby, where people aren't living there, but they're going through on the PCT. And that is highly disturbing for wildlife. Wildlife don't want to hang out near where people are. They can smell when people have been present. They can see them visually, obviously. And in some of these, pretty much all of these structures, people have been temporarily camping, including the PCT trail structure. Next slide. Oh, yeah. Just keep going.
I do want to point out, remember I said earlier, we kind of we took the data we saw and we were able to calibrate it to the amount of time that we had. So the human presence was normalized for effort by dividing number of human observation by trap days. And the same thing was done for species. So if a camera trap was only active for 2 days, that was taken into account for camera traps that were active for the whole year and a half. Yes.
Thanks. That's a good point.
It ranges. It's about 200-ish, I would say, at the present moment. From my last order of cameras. So every time one gets taken, we obviously have another $200 to spend. And then I do want to say about 50% of the way into the project, we said, okay, this is a lot of cameras getting stolen. What are we going to do? We fortified, we went out and we did brand new cameras everywhere and we fortified them all. So we put camera locks on as well as cable locks in some areas. We put a concrete post into the ground to see if we could get it to stay. We labeled them with CBCC and UC Davis and contact information. Within 2 months, most of those 30 cameras that we put out over those 2 days were gone. Lock were cut. Yeah, it almost made it a moving target. Like, ooh, let's go try and break this lock, a challenge. So we found that the best way was actually hide them in plain sight. And not lock them up. And then because you're also losing the money then on locks and the safety boxes and everything else. And on top of that, costs are not only just the camera, you also have to replace batteries and put SD cards in every single time. And each of those are serviced about once a month is what we try and get out there. So it's a lot of incurring costs.
Yeah, especially lost data.
Time that you purchased it and installed it.
It varied a lot on the western end was where we were getting cameras stolen. Like I would come out the next month and they'd be gone. We did at one point try to put cell cameras out there, and cell cameras are live transmissions. So every single time it captures a picture, it sends it and uploads it. Those are very expensive. So we only got about 6 just to test this, and some were gone within 2 days. And those are like, again, they're a little bit bigger because they have like a little receiving thing, but we would put them in like the rocks and camouflage them with like, we'd spray paint like sand and natural area on them. The one I think lasted the longest was a couple of weeks. So it's, yeah.
Well, we know the animals aren't stealing them.
It's correct. Yeah. And as you'll see, the higher numbers are focused on the highway, not in the background.
Yeah.
A lot of our background cameras actually lasted. We had a few last the entire year and a half, 2 years. So it's really the humans around the structures.
Have you ever thought about putting some kind of tag on them?
Yes and no. So when we go, we do camera recon. So we'll look around and say, can we find that SD card to pick up any data? But usually the cameras are totally broken into pieces. They'll find out very quickly they can't resell them for very much. So we'll find a battery over there, the battery pack over there, half a camera over there. The cell ones are tracked. The cell cameras are tracked, but they destroy them pretty fast.
And so does this occur regularly in other studies and other, if Frazier has done this, many years?
This is probably the highest rate of theft we've ever had, and all of our work is on pretty much on highways. Wow. Including Bay Area highways, other highways in Southern California, the Sierra Nevada and so forth. So yeah, this is by far the highest, and I think it's because it's relatively easy to access and the structures provide shelter and sometimes water. So if you need shelter and water, then a San Gregorio River Bridge is a pretty good spot. It's cooler under there. It's, you know, there's something to drink. So I think that's a lot of it.
And we're doing kind of a part two of this project with small mammals. And so our study area has expanded very far to the east. And so I've been setting up cameras in the east, and those areas where there's no urbanization, we're still having cameras get stolen, but at a far lesser rate. I've had cameras out for about 4 months now, and only about 3 of those stolen, 2.
Let's continue the presentation. I know this is an issue, but it's been an issue ever since.
Yes.
KD, you were out here 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and this, it was the same crime rate that was going on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think we can escape it. We can try different methods for animal detection. That's pretty much the only way. So all of this data collection and our analysis then led to some focused recommendations. We zoomed in primarily on the Stubby and Whitewater River areas. We also looked at some of the other existing structures, but right now we're looking primarily at these two. The Stubby structure has the PCT going through one of the two bays, and then the other one is not officially a trail structure, but it does get some human use, but it actually gets a lot more wildlife use. When wildlife go through, they'll tend to go through the non-PCT side, but there's still people there, so it's not great. Next slide. Zooming in there, there is conservation land on both sides, CVCC on the north and BLM to the south. There you can see right in the middle is the Stubby structure, and there's an overcrossing to the east, road overcrossing, that's relatively low volume. And so one thing we've considered is, would it be possible to move the PCT crossing over the I-10 to the east over that bridge? In other words, it's the trail actually comes from the east, so it doesn't lengthen the trail at all. It just puts it on a road for about a quarter of a mile so that the wildlife can use that structure. So we're looking at that kind of those design ideas for this structure, because to build something this size for wildlife would cost probably $40 or $50 million. So could you take that savings and apply it, even just a little bit of it, to nearby infrastructure and get the people out of the undercrossing, essentially? Next slide. And this is a very high biodiversity area. The yellow line along I-10 indicates that this is the highest number of observed species. It's also a relatively high number of predicted species in this location. But the red to yellow background there, that's the noise model. And near the highway, the noise levels are higher than you would really want them to be for some of the more sensitive species. So in order for wildlife to use this structure reliably, you'd want to mask that noise and then light. And light is a little easier to mask than the noise is. And so we're looking at designing mitigation structures, noise barriers on both sides of Stubby to basically create a quiet path to the structure. Next slide. And we're working with Dokken Engineering to do that. So they're an engineering team. The other structure we're looking at is, as an existing structure, is the Whitewater Bridge. That's got, it's very large. It's scouring considerably at its base. And so you can see where the concrete pilings are being caved, essentially gnawed away at by material in the water. And that may have been related to the loss of the county bridge to the north, because once that was gone, it made the highway the pinch point for the water. It probably protected the highway at some point when it was intact. Now that's gone, and so the highway is bearing the brunt of all of that. So there's a lot of erosion through there. And because of the erosion through that area, there's very little riparian vegetation. So we've done wildlife data collection there. We're not seeing a lot of wildlife through there, even though there's a lot of wildlife to the north and south. And it's probably because it's just a very wide open, hot, rocky area, not a lot of cover, so not a lot of wildlife. There are bighorn pretty close to that area to the north. And because it is a big river and it holds water and therefore is attractive, and there's bighorn to the north, we did look at this area as a potential overcrossing area to the east. The land to the south that says CVCC is actually not CVCC, so the map is mislabeled. But it is land that we think could potentially, we could negotiate, do some negotiation and maybe get some rights, some easement rights on the side that faces the highway. And then BLM land, which has those facilities on the north side, that would be the other side. So we're looking at a potential overcrossing location here at I-10 at Whitewater, just east of Whitewater. We're actually also starting to look at a overcrossing location west of Stubby. And really, those are the only two places that we could really find where we could reasonably create an overcrossing. Why don't we just move on from this one? Cool, thanks. There's two kinds of structures that we've really been talking about. One is overcrossings. Those are good for animals that really just don't tolerate undercrossings. Bighorn sheep will go through fairly large, like very tall, essentially tall bridges. They'll go underneath, like the Morongo Wash Bridge under for Highway 62. Big Horn Sheep will go through that. They'll go through kind of tentatively, so it's not like they're just pouring through. Overcrossings, though, they will prefer, and that's true for kangaroo rats and other species that don't like to go in tunnels. The cons is that they tend to be expensive, but if we look at undercrossings in comparison, if you were to build an undercrossing big enough to function for these various species, it's going to be possibly even more expensive than an overcrossing, especially for an interstate like Highway 10, like Interstate 10, which is very wide, and so you're talking about a big structure. Undercrossings are tolerated or used by more species or a lot of species when they don't have people in them. So that's a big consideration. And if they have not a lot of noise and light disturbance on their opening. So you can imagine that an animal coming up to a tunnel, it is just looking at traffic and it's very loud, it's less likely to even get there to use the tunnel. But if it's dark and quiet, then they'll use. A lot of species will use tunnels pretty regularly or readily. Next slide. So our next steps, we are doing some follow-up. We didn't think we'd be needing to do field data collection continuing for so long, but we are mostly because of camera theft and just not having enough data for some of these structures. We're working with the dock and engineering team on location and design of different actions that could be done. This picture of a bobcat is at the Whitewater River. So that's a place that we're really hoping can function a little better. And then one of our main focuses is on noise and light mitigation, because this is it's a relatively inexpensive way to take a many million-dollar structure and make it more functional for wildlife. So you essentially take something that maybe has low functionality for wildlife and you make it high functionality, but you don't have to pay for the bridge. So that's the big advantage of some of these existing structures. Whitewater River, a special side case for that. Caltrans may be modifying the Whitewater River bridge, in other words, taking it out and putting in a much longer bridge. So we're focusing on that in terms of recommendations, but we're keeping them non-specific because we don't actually know what they're going to do there. They're going to have to do something because those pilings aren't going to last forever. Next slide. Oh, that's it. Happy to take any questions if there's any time left. Otherwise, feel free to talk to Shannon. She can get you my email address, and we can talk by email too if you want.
All right. Thank you, Professor. Thanks, Shannon. One quick one, Professor. You had mentioned moving the PCT traffic away from the Stubby Wash crossing and using the Haugen-Lehmann existing highway bridge there. But one of the reasons I think the PCC routing goes there and works the way it does, there's also a railroad undercrossing there, which there isn't on the other side, unless that I've noticed.
Yeah.
So would that create a problem in diverting that traffic?
You are frozen, Fraser.
We lost your voice.
Can you hear me now?
There you go.
Okay. Yeah, so we talked about that, and I know this will sound odd, but just bear with me. It would be much less expensive to build a pedestrian overcrossing over the railway than to build a new overcrossing or undercrossing for wildlife anywhere on I-10. So in terms of a creative fix, just building that pedestrian crossing for the PCT over the railway to allow them to get to the Haugen-Lehmann Road and access the trail that way, all of those different things that you do, you could even build a rest area there to replace that function that they're using at the Stubby Bridge, build a rest area with water and shade and everything. All of those things would cost much less than building a new structure. So it's really that kind of trade-off. And often the consideration is, well, who pays for it, right? Like the PCT people don't have to pay for it. So why should they relinquish any control over that? Well, that bridge is not actually, I don't think it's really intended for humans. So there's that whole issue, but it has been traditionally used. So if they were, forgiving and flexible and said, okay, fine, we'll walk over a pedestrian crossing bridge over the rail, and we're happy to use that rest area so that the wildlife can use that undercrossing. That's really the trade-off, is a kind of a doing good kind of trade-off, which would allow us to access that very large bridge.
Yeah. No, and that crossing is kind of a rest area. A lot of the trail ends, you'll put water and things out there for it.
Yeah, exactly.
We got one couple quick questions and then we can move on.
Is there a mandate for this by the state?
There is, there are requirements in our plan to continue to monitor wildlife and the species we protect, and to do things to make sure that we either protect them or increase the number of individuals. And this is a special area in the multiple species plan where we're given some focus. Can the wildlife agencies compel us to build a $40 million structure? Probably not. However, there may be some things that we could do in the interim about related to sound and noise, as our colleagues here point out, that are much less expensive.
Yeah, but you know, just because we see 50 species over a year and a half period, you may see the same thing if you had a camera, a trail cam in the cove in La Quinta. Okay? I mean, doesn't mean that, you know, I've lived here my entire life. I don't see a lot of animals on I-10 that are being, when I drive on it, that are dead. You know, these overpasses and underpasses are done in like Canada. If you've ever been to Canada, they have huge, but they've got moose and bears and things that when people hit them, they die. And then the population. So I don't know if it's worth, you know, we have so many things to worry about. We can't worry about everything. And I understand, and maybe this is a big thing. Maybe it's so huge that we have to, but maybe it's not. And maybe we should take the money, the limited funds we have, and use it on other things, you know. Not to mean that this is less important, but just say that, you know, we have to pick and choose.
Yeah. I think that you have a point. If you had to pay for the whole thing, I think that it's these days leveraging what you've already done, what you're paying for now, to get state funds through Wildlife Conservation Board or to have Caltrans do something special like a whitewater river. That's really the ticket. So you spend, you know, $500,000 and hopefully get the state to spend $50 million to build a new crossing, if that's what's needed. In other words, I, for a lot of local agencies, I don't think they're going to pay for it. It's really, can you persuade the state, make the case that this is really critical to connect those string of pearls that you were talking about? This is a really critical spot and we need state support.
I get that, but someone's paying for it. I mean, the money's not free. We didn't print it. I mean, it's just someone's paying for it. So, you know, we don't want to create more and more. That's all. I mean, this is just my
supervisor. One last question.
Thank you. Obviously, I understand our jurisdiction moves in that direction, and thank you for the information. I'm more interested in District 4, meaning that the Hot Springs, Palm Springs, all the way down to the North Shore area. I'm wondering if you happen to have any data in our area as opposed to the 5th District and actually moving out of Palm Springs and going into the Morongo, Cabazon. I get it because that's our jurisdiction. Nonetheless, though, I'm just wondering if you actually had a chance to look into this area at all.
Anything else?
Yeah. Is that
going to
be answered?
Was that a question? Yeah. So our next question. Actually, Shannon just came back. Our new study area does go out to the east, and we are doing more data collection in that direction. We can provide you more detailed follow-up if you'd like.
Thank you. No, I just wanted to know that. Thank you.
Just a quick question. Part of the reason for the study and the delay on the state's decision is this spring is to collect more data, given the barriers that we've experienced. Will we meet that deadline to provide whatever data needed for them to determine the it talks about the fact that the question on the Western Burrowing Owl.
And that's will be discussed on the next agenda item.
Okay.
It's not so directly related to this. The part of this presentation we failed to provide is why are we doing it here? And there are pinch points, and it's not really about getting individuals under or over a freeway to protect them. It's protect the genetic stock. You don't want to leave 5 individuals on one side of a freeway and 1,000 or 10,000 on another side because things go wrong genetically with only 5 individuals on one side. So there are these important places in the plan, and this is a really important place in the plan. And Katie will do a better job of explaining that in the future than I ever could. We do need to move on though.
that's fair.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate
it. Thanks, everybody.
Take care.
Next up, our good friends, the Burrowing Owls, with the permitting update. Katie?
We will provide absolutely a lot more information about this Debbie Undercrossing. In fact, I'm going to take you way back into the way before the plan was created. But with this presentation, I just wanted to say I'm here today to provide a little bit of background and also a little bit of history about the Burrowing Owls under this item. I wanted to make sure that we addressed key concerns that were sent to you in a letter back in September from the wildlife agencies. That formal letter to the CVCC had copies going out to city managers and key staff and permittees addressing concerns of burrowing owl permit compliance. We have been doing a significant amount of work since the plan has been created. And even before the plan was created, I wanted to talk a little bit more about both the natural history of burrowing owls in the valley and give you a little bit of background so that you have more context of where we are with this particular letter. So our friends, these little burrowing owls, you know, they have significant nests and roosts throughout the valley. Well, at least we know that now. So they live in these little underground burrows. I'm sure some of you have seen them out there. And they're basically typically excavated by other mammals, or tortoises. So these they do not dig their own burrows. They may clear them out, but they take over their opportunistic burrow hunters, pretty much. And they find these little places. Sometimes I call them erosional crags, but basically areas that are open within some particular soils that are very, very productive for their particular nests. They're active at night and they forage from dusk until dawn. But you can definitely see them out during the day, and many of us do. And they feed primarily on large insects and small rodents, but they'll take a wide variety of prey. In fact, in the early days of the plan, there was a lot of concern that these guys were eating the Palm Springs pocket mouse, and they are. We've documented that. But within the landscape level of our plan, the conservation objectives are to conserve these as an ecosystem. And we know these guys often take Palm Springs pocket mice. So, one of the things that we wanted to cover today is why now? Why is there so much concern now? So even though burrowing owls seem to be doing very well in our valley, conservation groups in Northern California have become really concerned with the populations that are up around the Bay Area. And they're seeing a lot of decades of decline up there. So the California Department of Fish and Game Commission, they decided to list the burrowing owl or petition to list the burrowing owl as endangered under our CESA, our California Endangered Species Act. In October of 2024, they agreed that this designation would provide interim protection like they're a fully endangered species. And so from now until that decision is made, we're basically looking at them as protection of endangered species. But I wanted to applaud some of the foresight that was done at the early parts of the plan, because back in the 90s, before the plan was created, biologists were sent from the state to survey throughout the Coachella Valley, and they had told us that the burrowing owl was extirpated, meaning it no longer lives here within the Coachella Valley back in the 90s. The reason for this is protocol. So they had taken a state protocol and basically revisited many of the historic locations that were known in the valley and had found no burrowing owls there. So if you go back to these burrows can be established for decades. And some of them, sometimes they erode, sometimes they collapse, but they went back to these historic locations and they didn't find any burrowing owls there. So their overall prediction was there were no burrowing owls in the valley and that they had been extirpated. So when the plan was starting to generate all of the biological data that went behind the modeling and all of the surveys and everything to get an idea of where we needed to create the conservation areas, we basically found that the state protocol was not going to be sufficient. The Earth Scientific Advisory Committee at the time, they sent out a few biologists. And they took all the historic locations that were within recent years that people had observed We didn't have iNaturalist back then. And basically went around to the different museums and found things. And between that and our permits is written in that we have 74 known locations within the valley. So that was between 2000 and 2007 that data was taken. And 41 of those known locations are supposed to be conserved within the conservation areas, and then 16 pairs as well. This is a typical habitat for the burrowing owls. You can see, usually they have the soft soil underneath, and it's usually some kind of bank or a riverbank that you see them in. So there's that the sandy or soil at the bottom here that's been dug out. This is typical for habitat across the valley. And that's why at the beginning of the plan, we had to do a survey, a regional survey call for levees, berms, and dikes along of known alluvial areas where we had flooding and or rivers, creeks, things of that sort, or the stormwater channel. So we got together, we talked with the wildlife agencies, and we created a strategy. And one of that strategy was that when the plan was first created, we didn't really have an idea where the burrowing owls would continue to be or would continue to persist. So CDFW awarded CVCC a local assistance grant in September of 2009, which paid our team to basically go out and create a reliable baseline. As a biologist, I hate that word, but baseline of distribution and abundance of burrowing owls. It's a snapshot, okay? It was a snapshot of what happened in 2009. We, at that time, found about 86 owls inside and outside the conservation areas. This is, again, along levees, berms, and dikes. So you can see the stormwater channels there, some agricultural areas, but mostly Mission Creek, Little Moronga Wash, some areas outlying in Desert Hot Springs, Whitewater River. So you can see here, the different routes noted here are in 2009, we did all of these routes. In 2011, the Reserve Management Oversight Committee, which included the wildlife agencies, dropped the ones in red and added the ones in green. So we had about 50 linear routes and 88 known owl locations at that time. Over 40 pairs, more than 60% in the conservation area. So we had changed the protocol, and that is important because when we change protocols or when we do any kind of science under the plan, we're required to try to have our peers review it and publish it within peer-reviewed journals so that other scientists can pick it apart, put it back together, say this is inadequate, this is adequate. So this was published in a peer-reviewed journal, and all of this information that I'm telling you is not only linked in the staff report, but it's also linked in many of our annual reports. So we had 53 occupied locations, 88 owls or so, and about 60% of those were in the conservation areas. And I just want to highlight again, this survey protocol was approved by RMUC and RMOC with wildlife agencies at the head. And this became the driver for where we knew these owls were. And after that, we did a number of different studies that basically identified where these owls were, where their nests were, and what was going on with their food sources. Also, what was going on in terms of their distribution across the region. And the reason for this is because most of our conservation areas, or actually nearly all of our conservation areas, are based on modeling. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife models that Dr. Schilling mentioned, those models come from habitat suitability models, which basically predict where this species is going to be. If you put all those models together, you get an overlap of where our conservation areas are for our listed species. The burrowing owl did not have a model because in the 90s, it was considered extirpated. So it was not found in the valley. So it was really the directive of that original study, 2009 and 2011, to create enough observations so that we could create a model for CBAG, and then turn around and use that model to help conserve through the interim and long-term conservation strategy. Really quick, from west to east, you can see the distribution of owls here. The highlight here is this is Mission Creek and Little Moronga Wash. That'll be important later, so I just wanna make sure that I highlight that. The other peak here is the stormwater channel. And the Cottonwood Canyon Whitewater River area. So there's Stubby again. It's over there. So what happened was when we created this model, the niche model, or what we call the habitat suitability model, it told us where we could find these owls. Really quickly, I just want to point out these green dots, all of the lighter green dots that you can see, these are all within the conservation area. The red dots are owl occurrences that have been found outside the conservation area. And as you notice, most of the stormwater channel is not in the conservation area. So it was very important that we work with CVWD, IID, and flood control to identify operations and maintenance behaviors and manuals that would be able to protect the owls that were in those areas. And we had done that, and that's actually completed in 2015 and was published as part of our annual report as well. The interim conservation strategy here, if anybody didn't realize, before I go to that, we wanted to make sure that we understood a couple of different things, but before I go to back, run really, really quick back to this map, Desert Hot Springs wasn't part of the plan back then. So one of the main interim conservation strategies was really to bring in the major amendment to the MSHCP, and it added Desert Hot Springs as a permittee under the plan and Mission Springs Water District properties as well. And those were critical for a number of these different locations. So that was completed in 2016. And then we really wanted to make sure that we were protecting that, that habitat. So the highest priority threats were dumping, off-highway vehicle use, everything that we just went over with Diana from the property that you just purchased off of Dillon Avenue. That's critical burrowing owl habitat, and it is occupied. So we have in Upper Mission Creek and Big Morongo Canyon Conservation Area alone, Diana already covered this, but approximately a little bit more than 7,000 acres out of the 10,000 acres that we're supposed to be acquiring. That's all been completed, and we're looking at a cost of almost $24 million to do that overall. And then the cleanup costs themselves have, without the CalRecycle grant, we're not talking about almost $500,000 for the cleanup and the fencing and the protection of these areas. So nearly all of that observed occupied habitat from the 2009 and 2011 surveys had been conserved, and the parcels had been fenced and signed, and we've done all of these management efforts. And we were meeting the minimum of the 16 pairs per year within the conservation area, the 40 individuals, we knew they were out there. So the RMOC said, we're not gonna do these region-wide surveys anymore. We're gonna actually focus on the nesting questions. What, you know, how productive are these nests? How many owlets are they putting out? How many owlets are fledging? What type of things are they eating? And so all of those were related to the long-term conservation strategy. So at that point, we moved forward with that. One of those conservation questions was, where are owls coming from? And this is it's an isotopic study where basically we took water samples from around the valley. We have an isotopic signature for a number of these, for like basically a map that we create from the water. And there's deuterium and carbon and nitrogen, the isotopes that we analyzed. And what you can see here is that there's three groups. Mostly what I'm showing you here is that there's like a Western Riverside group. There's the Western Coachella Valley group, which is kind of focused in the area that we were just talking about, Upper Mission Creek. And then there's Eastern Coachella Valley Ag. And what we were seeing is every once in a while you get transients that would come from Mexico or from Western Riverside. This was before genetics, guys. We didn't really have genetics to be able to do all of the stuff. So we did.
How much longer is your presentation?
About 5 minutes.
All right.
I have some questions.
Yeah, and some of you are wondering, why are we getting a lecture on this? This has serious implications.
Very serious.
Particularly for the water districts, irrigation districts, Desert Hot Springs. And we're trying to put this all into the public record that we've been doing a lot on the burrowing owl. So I appreciate a little bit of patience on this. Katie, wrap it up, and then we will have questions.
Sure. So the point being is that for the next 10 years, is basically the Reserve Management Oversight Committee focused on nest monitoring. up until about 2020. And we were really interested in understanding how productive were our nests. We did about 10 nests per year, sampled from across the areas. And this is kind of what that looks like. So throughout the Desert Hot Springs area, we would sample at least 5 nests. And on the stormwater channel, we would sample at least 5 nests. So this was done in partnership with CBWD and the tribes in the area too. Sorry. most threats that we found, obviously, dogs and others. This is a coyote, of course. And these wildlife cameras that were placed at the nests really helped to inform us about what kind of foods they were eating, how productive the nests were, and how many owls were actually fledging. And we were seeing a very productive areas within these conservation areas. Moral of the story, the ravens tended to be the highest issue out there, and the ravens are, they're subsidized by the dumping. So that, again, reinforced the fact that we needed to deal with the dumping, do the fencing, and provided the recommendations for that.
Football team, they're dirty birds.
So, and the focus area here, this is kind of the showing of some of the fencing and things of that sort, protecting that area. This started in 2014, actually even before the major amendment was completed. And since then we've fenced about several miles of this area and significant amount of
miles,
13 miles overall, but those are in Sky Valley as well. So, and Thousand Palms. So our overall consideration now is to try to understand what our genetics are doing. The Imperial Irrigation District and Director Cardenas, their team at AECOM, the biologists have performed a region-wide census of burrowing owls, repeating and expanding the methodology from 2009 and 2011, but also with a reduced number of samples. So 2 versus 5 repeats per route. And so all indications from that preliminarily, our population estimates have at least tripled in the Coachella Valley in the last 17 years. So I'm telling you all of that to tell you this, we're still doing work. We have Dr. Conway and the University of Idaho out there who are going to be banding and putting little backpacks on each one of some of these owls to understand a little bit more about it, as taking samples from them for genetics testing. So we finally get the final answer for where these owls are coming from. Most of our owls are residents, we know that, but there are migrants that are coming in from deserts like Utah, Las Vegas, but also just kind of moving about in many different areas. The final discussion here is really about the concern over passive and active relocation. So one of the issues that we've had in the plan when a development comes in is that we commonly passively relocate those owls, meaning they put a door on the burrows and once the owls go out, they can't come back in. Significant issues in trying to figure out whether we can do active relocation, which is basically providing a burrow like this and putting the owls within a hacking cage and trying to get them localized to a particular area. So these burrows were provided outside the conservation area near a CBWD facility, and it was with a CEC grant from the California Energy Commission and also the California Department of Fish and Wildlife that helped to fund this particular conservation research. And San Diego Zoo Institute was our lead researchers on that. Finally, we just want to make sure that we know how they're moving through the region and also how they're moving between regions. So as part of the conservation questions related to the potential listing, are we getting owls that are moving in? This is obviously, this owl has moved from Indio to Thousand Palms across the Indio Hills, which is exactly what that conservation area was created for. Really focusing on trying to understand if these owls are going west, if they're traveling through the past, are they actually getting into Western Riverside? Are they actually getting into Orange County? And are they getting into the Imperial Valley? All of these are very important questions overall. And really what I want to highlight here is that we've been working with the wildlife agencies on every step of the way on this. So it was a little surprising when we got the formal letter from them in terms of the long-term conservation strategy. The information as presented today This has been submitted with comprehensive documentation to the wildlife agencies and particularly to California Department of Fish and Wildlife so that they can analyze the population issues that we've had out here. Actually, also the interest in the request for data and reports is really so that the decision can finalize and kind of document what we've done out here. So with that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
I have a comment. I'm going to just go through this pretty quick, but number one, receiving a joint letter from a federal and state agency questioning our expressing concerns regarding our conservation efforts, especially when it comes to the diversity of Coachella Valley, is very concerning. We're clearly playing defense instead of offense, and not only will it be rigorous, it'll be incredibly expensive.
Yes.
So usually the cadence that's involved when dealing with an HCP type of notification is the formal letter should not be a surprise. So the first question I have maybe is just for investigation, because we're out of time, is how did we get from, you know, this incredible plan to actually getting a formal letter? Because usually there's roundtables that happen in between before the formal letter, and I don't need a response now because we're almost out of time. The other important thing is that it appears to be so egregious that they gave notice to all the city managers as well, which is not a common practice in terms of the formal letter. So there's a lot of homework to be done. So at minimum, what I'm asking is that we respond to those city managers, or that you use your discretion in terms of it's appropriate to respond to the city managers regarding our efforts. The staff report that's being provided is excellent because it does provide a history and our commitment to the biodiversity of the Coachella Valley. So I think this is a very important step, but we may have to follow up with those city managers and put them on notice that not only are we going to cooperate, but we are addressing it and have a comprehensive history in doing that. So what I'm maybe asking, Mr. Kirk, is that we do bring this item back maybe at our next meeting and just get an update. And number one, we have maybe had some contact with those city managers, that we do have some roundtables scheduled to address the former letter, and that we tap into IAD resources. Again, us playing offense regarding HCP type of situations is incredibly expensive. There's a lot of resurveying that's already been done that you can use it, but this is very concerning, and especially if we're still gonna be making acquisition of property, because I mean, you talk about slamming the brakes and people flying through the windshield. This is the perfect scenario of that. So I don't even know how we can make acquisitions in the future unless we thoroughly address this to ensure that we are protecting and they have a clear understanding that we are committed to the biodiversity of the Coachella Valley. So I'll leave it right there because I know we're out of time, but ultimately defer to this agency and to you.
Yeah, I would recommend, chairs, we postpone the discussion on our cleanup effort and have Will come back at the next meeting and do so, by which time we'll have done even more of the cleanup and we could finish this conversation and you could adjourn the meeting. With respect to the second part of your question and comments, I have been in contact with the city managers and general managers. We have set up a number of working groups and discussions. Some of the city managers are not going to need to pay attention to this. If you're a landlocked community without burrowing owls and not a lot of development in such areas, the others are very engaged and very interested. And we're committed to preparing a joint letter. And we applaud the good work that IID is doing, not only within their service area, but slightly out of it in the Coachella Valley, outside of your territory. With respect to the first part of your question, were you surprised? KD, were you surprised?
So we had been having discussions. We have a regular coordination meeting at the wildlife agencies, and we have been getting integral issues identified through this permitting process that it had not been interpreted in that way before. So we have become increasingly concerned. We did receive identification that something was coming. We didn't realize it was going to have the tone that it did. And so I do want to highlight, in February, we sent all of this information to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And sometimes it feels like they hadn't read that letter. So part of it was that was surprising. Like, we have done all of these things and it feels like it's almost been ignored.
Yep.
So no, your point is well taken, and you're spot on. We've done all this work. Those stats don't lie. Those stats are amazing. And you look at the increase in the population, how our land efforts, the land that we have bought has created those wildlife corridors for those birds to migrate on, and all of those issues. It's a matter of getting the folks in Sacramento to recognize that. But yeah. you and that's one of the reasons we have this presentation today. And so hopefully we're laying the groundwork to do that. And we have the roundtable working with city managers. I face this problem in Desert Hot Springs ridiculously every day out mm-hmm. there, because we've got the development out there. And the whole purpose of the multi-species habitat plan was for us to be able to develop areas and not have to worry about things like this. And we're still with that. So Katie and the staff are doing a great job with this. And I think, an update in our January meeting would be in order. And so we can go with that. Anybody else have any questions for Katie? And do you want to go ahead and move our cleanup discussion, or do you think
we have time? Up to you. Will, how quickly can you give an update?
Minutes.
Well, you've got eight. Make a quick update.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Katie. Yeah, we just need to have a quick update on our dumping encampment in the Upper Mixon Creek and the Morongo Canyon areas. So, Will.
All right. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Will Steichen, management analyst for CVCC. We've been talking a lot about the Upper Mission Creek, Big Morongo Canyon conservation areas. So you've seen this slide. This is where this cleanup effort is taking place. Here is the project area. So this is transitional zones between conservation habitat and developed areas in and around the city of Desert Hot Springs. The area is made up of soft sand dunes, washes, and difficult to navigate access routes. So since 2019, CVCC has seen increasing challenges with illegal dumping and encampments in this area. And in early 2025, CVCC secured funding from CalRecycle's illegal disposal site abatement grant to clean up the area. So we identified 15 sites, which are highlighted here in our grant application. And as the project took place, we actually identified two additional sites. So we cleaned up 17 sites total. And we started with the phase one, focusing on 9 encampments south of Dillon, which you see circled here.
Very impressive.
All right. So the first step in this cleanup project was to address the encampment residents. And on September 24th, CVCC staff coordinated closely with Desert Hot Springs Police Department's Community Response Team, Code Compliance, SWAG, which is the Social Welfare Action Groups, the city's contracted homeless services, and Animal Control to provide eviction notices to each resident. Now, we gave 34 days to each of these residents, well above the 2-day required notice. We rented out a storage unit and offered storage space for personal belongings, and we assisted residents in moving any stuck vehicles that were drivable to roadway access. So through an RFP process, we contracted American Integrated Services as our cleanup crew and ENC Towing to remove vehicles. On the morning of the cleanup, the DHS team and CVC staff did our final outreach and eviction notices. Each resident left on their own accord. And American Integrated began working one site at a time while we towed vehicles across the project area. So now we get into the fun pictures. So this site, which on the maps shared with you, is site 12. We referred to this as the city. This site is located along the wash on the western side of the project area. You can see there's RVs, cars, boats, trailers, furniture, tires, fencing, built structures, and many other types of debris. So here is a built structure that you can see inside. It's got a heater, a stove, a bathroom. It has solar panels on top that are hooked up to a generator. So this really demonstrates the level of permanence that some of these encampments have gotten to. Now, during the cleanup, American Integrated Services had an 8-person crew that consisted of a skid steer and a hand crew on the ground. They were constantly filling and removing 40 cubic yard dumpsters. And this site alone took 2 full days between the cleanup crew and towing. And we had to work really closely between those two. They required a lot of coordination because they'd get the outside perimeter of the cleanup and then there'd be more vehicles able to be towed. And it worked back and forth as making sure to get access to all of the debris. So this is that site. Immediately after, there's still some light trash on the ground. There were boats and golf carts that had to be towed away as well. Here is actually the very first site we went to, which is close to Dillon. And with our assistance, the resident living here was able to voluntarily remove their RV. There was very heavy debris and remnants cleared by American Integrated. And this site really foreshadowed the challenges of the cleanup. The crews were often getting stuck in soft sand. So the towing company, instead of going out and removing vehicles, was having to come back and remove, or, you know, get unstuck the cleanup crews. So there was constant coordination that was required. The crews stacked all the hazardous material and set them aside. And as you can see, the bottom left here, they stacked tires as well that the Urban Conservation Corps will come out and clean up for free from us. We meet with them tomorrow to go over that project. Here's another site that we called the Dune site or the Dune compound. Now this was a large encampment built up against fault line dunes. And the dune is an especially environmentally sensitive ecosystem. The encampment contained multiple residents. There were dogs, broken vehicles, appliances, trash all over the place. And one of the residents actually worked on vehicles out there. So there were vehicle parts scattered all over the place and well over a dozen, you know, unoperating vehicles when we first showed up. So we started working through the cleanup of this site. This one also took us 2 days because it was just so much tires and heavy debris and everything. There were many dogs at this site, including an abandoned female and her 6 newborn puppies. So we worked with DHS's animal control. They responded very quickly and helped us remove those and bring them to a shelter. And here you can see the dune site afterward. There's still a couple trailers and RVs that were really dug into the ground that we're continuing to work on removing, but significant change from where it was to where it is now. We're now able to access the fault line dunes there. And immediately we went up and saw numerous species, including fringe-toed lizards. So that was really exciting for us. Here, as we finished the encampments, we now moved into just general sweep of the area. Let's see, you can see that there's all this different kinds of trash and debris all over. There's torn up blankets and beds that find their way into creosote bushes, burned out vehicles, all of that. So that's still out there and we're working on it. There were many dogs that we ran into throughout and with KD's, guidance. We had dog treats and food and water. So we actually managed the dogs away from the cleanup crews as they were cleaning. And just gives you a sense of what's out there, what we've been cleaning up. So by the numbers, there were 9 encampments that we removed and 0 of them required any law enforcement action. So each person left on their own accord. And that is because we really worked with them and gave them a notice. As of a week ago, we had 250,000 pounds of trash that we removed. It's definitely up from that number today, probably closer to 300,000. Again, a week ago, there was 25 cars, RVs, and trailers towed, probably over 30 now. And then as we moved into the second phase of the project, yesterday, all the hazardous waste was removed, and we're meeting tomorrow to have the tires removed. We addressed the other 17 dump sites. And then in the winter, we're going to be installing 4 Flock PTZ cameras. So they're the ones that see really far. And that's going to tie directly into Desert Hot Springs PD system. So we'll be able to respond quickly to any new encampments or dumpings that do happen on this land. We also have an MOU with Desert Hot Springs. They did weekly patrols from the day we gave notice to the day we did evictions. They included the social welfare groups in those patrols, and they will continue to do patrols of this area while we get a ranger program up and running. And with that,
yes, with this question, how are you going to keep that camera safe? My question.
That's a good question. So the cameras are installed on 18-foot poles.
Okay, good answer. Thank you.
and that probably won't protect them either, but it'll take them a little longer.
See what a mess that is. And if I had my way, we'd fence off the entire desert after seeing the stuff out there. But, you know, yes.
I just want to say thank you as a resident of Desert Hot Springs. It almost makes me want to cry. What you've done for our community is beyond words. And just make sure every person that worked on that project, all the tow truck drivers, they all get our sincere thanks.
Thank you.
How much of that is in county territory, would you say?
All of this is in within the city of Desert Hot Springs bound. Yep.
Is there a grant for?
No, what I'm saying is that if it's on county, obviously I could then mobilize the task force and those efforts. I'll still reach out and see what we can do to help support.
It's in the fabulous fourth.
In the fabulous fourth, but nonetheless, it's not on county.
I'm just glad they.
And that's your jurisdiction.
I'm just glad they categorized it as debris instead of art.
We know this, but we have a big billboard out there that has a pile of trash that says, "This is not an art installation. This is a $10,000 fine."
So that person that left in an RV, where did that RV go?
It's a good question.
It went to Dillon Road.
To a shredder.
In India.
Actually, several yards, 100 yards away or so.
So do you know?
Yeah. So a few of them have moved up into private land. A few of them we haven't seen. We have been doing patrols of the area. I'd say about half we know where they have moved, half we don't know where
they are. I thought they moved next to Linda's house.
We'll send them.
So, all right. Well, thank you so much. And hopefully we can put this on the January 1 as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe a quick follow-up, but also where we're at with our ranger force for that. Some other stuff for information on your packet. I see no other public comments.
Anything online?
Our next CVCC meeting will be next year, January 8th, 10:30, here in this very room. And without further ado, then we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.